Welcome to the Hoops Hype Podcast. My name is Alex Kennedy. This is episode number 219. We post new episodes twice a week, so be sure to check back and subscribe. Joining me today is Shea Cotton, who is one of the best high school players of all time, and who has a new documentary coming out about his basketball journey. On June 23rd, you can check out Manchild, The Shea Cotton Story, on demand and on all digital platforms such as iTunes, Amazon, anywhere movies are found. The documentary looks at Shea's life and features interviews with Baron Davis, Elton Brand, Paul Pierce, Steven Jackson, Meta World Peace, Tyson Chandler, and Randy Moss, among others. Shea, thanks for joining me. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me, Alex.
I'm so excited to talk to you. This documentary, Manchild, The Shea Cotton Story, is all about your journey as a basketball player, and it's so well done. I really enjoyed watching it last night. When did this documentary start coming together?
Great question, Alex. I really appreciate it. My production team, R True Group, did a great job with the head director, Eric Patah Herbert, and the host of guys in the team. The documentary came into existence in the last, I'd say, 10 to 15 years. It was an idea. And then, within the last 10 years, it went into production. We did a lot of editing and fresh takes. We did a lot of high definition late footage with all the NBA players that you see in it. And when people watch it, a lot of that stuff is the newer content. A lot of the old pixelated footage is the stuff that my father shot when I played. My father didn't miss a game. And if he did, he made sure he got the film so he could watch it. So by him taping every game gave me an opportunity to be more of a student of the game. And I would analyze every night after I played my mistakes and write them down and just kind of study and make sure I didn't make the same mistake the next game. So me and my brother would do that. And that was very helpful along the way. But this film came into existence because I wanted to do something with the latter part of my life that was greater than what I did when I played. And I felt like, putting my life on the canvas, telling my story to help people avoid some of these pitfalls that I had to go through so no one else goes through them, I think was more important than, than any game I played or, how well I played when I was at the pinnacle of my career. So with that being said, we showed it in 2016 at LA Film Festival. It ranked top five out of 4,200 films. So we knew we had a good product at that point because, to make it in LA, you got to make it in Hollywood. And they were very pleased with the project. So we've been really motivated since then. It's been a difficult process. It's been 4 years to get to this point to distribute, but we're blessed to be in a position now. We partnered up with 1091 Media, who did the Stephon Marbury story recently, a kid from Coney Island, as well as the Lloyd Daniels Sweet Pea story. So we're excited. Obviously everybody was hooked on The Last Dance with the Jordan 10-part docuseries, which was great. I watched it myself, but I feel like our timing is good right now, unfortunately, with the state of our country with the COVID-19. But, with that being said, this is available obviously on all digital streaming platforms, iTunes, Amazon, and anywhere you can purchase movies.
Yeah, it comes out June 23rd. I think the timing is perfect because so many people are watching The Last Dance, Tiger King. It feels like everyone's kind of watching documentaries right now and looking for something to fill the void, especially sports related, because we're all missing sports, obviously. But let's talk about your development as a player. It was so interesting watching how you came up. And like you said, I'm so glad that your dad took those videos and had all those videos because someone would reference a certain dunk. And then sure enough, there's a video of it. Someone would mention a certain camp you went to, and then there was a bunch of videos from it. I mean, I was really impressed with how much video there was, but I mean, you were described as a man child, a man among boys, godlike, and things like that. When did you hit your growth spurt, and when did you realize that you were a special athlete?
I think I hit my growth spurt between middle school going into high school. I went from like 5'9 to 6'1 to like 6'4 in like a period of like 2 years. And when that happened, my body was developing. I was training at an alarming rate. Me and my brother would challenge each other, countless hours. And I think that's what separated me. The physical component and understanding the game and not being scared to play against bigger, stronger opponents and older guys. So I'd probably say, for me, the maturation process really started kicking in 15 and 16 years old. I started separating myself because I was training at a much, 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 much more aggressive pace than my peers, and then having the opportunity to glean from my brother, which was 2.5 years older, to get that wisdom and that insight and develop a different level of work ethic at the same time.
For people who don't know your story, you were the top player in your age group. Guys like Elton Brand, Baron Davis, Tyson Chandler, Paul Pierce, Steven Jackson, Meta World Peace, Randy Moss, they're all interviewed in the documentary and they praise your game and say, that was who we were trying to become. We were trying to take down Shea. He was number one. So, I mean, these NBA players, these guys that went on to have exceptional careers, talk about how you were better than them. So, I mean, for people that don't know, I just want to fill them in. When did you dunk for the first time and when did you sign your first autograph?
My first dunk was in the sixth grade in Roanoke, Virginia, in the AAU National Championship game, which was very surreal, to actually get my first one in a game that big of that magnitude.
Yeah.
And the second question was
When did you sign your first autograph?
my first autograph. Great question. It was around that time. I believe it was after that game, actually, because at that time, nobody was really dunking. I mean, I'm in the sixth grade, I'm 5'9". But, I think at that time I had almost a 30-inch vertical leap. So, it was interesting at that time. We didn't have social media, so everybody that knew who was who, you had to come watch the players play, or you had to get the newspaper the next day and check the scores and stats and stuff like that. It wasn't as readily as accessible as it is today. So I think it was a bigger deal because there was less opportunity.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you weren't seeing, kids dunking left and right like you are today with some of the accounts and the mixtapes that are out there. So when you see a middle schooler dunking, you're thinking, I need to talk to this kid. I need to get his autograph. So let's talk about that attention. You're 12 years old. You're signing autographs. You're getting media attention. Everyone knows you locally. You're becoming a pretty big name in California. Your family talked about how you had to grow up really fast and get used to being under the microscope at 12 years old. What was that like?
I mean, living in a fishbowl at the end of the day. I mean, I was a national figure at 12, 13 years old. I'm on ESPN, Scholastic Sports America, Sun Kissed Kids. That was the pinnacle at that time. People need to understand, I came along before social media. So I didn't get that YouTube and those IG likes and stuff like that from what I was doing in my prime. If I would have had access to social media, we would have broke the internet. So for me, it was more about, what do I want to be remembered as? There's a lot of people that play basketball, but I wanted to separate myself from my peers by my play. And that took a work ethic, that took a desire, that took a lot of courage and a commitment day in and day out. Because there was a lot of days when I didn't feel like playing and guys were coming after me because I was already a national figure and I had a name. So everybody wanted to make a name on me, which means I couldn't have any off days because we had Nike reps coming to all the games, a slew of high D1 college coaches. I mean, I can remember, I'm 16 years old in the summer playing in it with my AAU team, SoCal All-Stars, and I see the front row of some bleachers in the UNLV, and I'm looking around. I said, wow, there's Jerry Tarkanian, Mike Krzyzewski, Roy Williams, Jim Boeheim, Lute Olson, Jim Herrick. I mean, these are the biggest names at that time for the universities. From I just named Arizona, Duke, UCLA, Syracuse. I mean, how much bigger do we need to get?
Right,
And I'm
wow.
16. I'm 16 years old, and a lot of these coaches are recruiting me along with some of my other teammates and guys that we were playing against. But primarily for my team, they were coming to see me, and they discovered other guys
Wow, yeah,
as well.
that's incredible. Let's talk about the social media aspect. If social media had been around when you were playing in high school, when you were coming up, you would have been like a Zion Williamson who became a household name in high school. A guy like Andrew Wiggins, we saw at 13 years old, he had a mixtape that was viral and everyone kind of watched him develop as a player and grow up. Are you glad that you didn't have to deal with that kind of attention? Because, your mom points out the Sports Illustrated article and all the attention you were getting, it was almost overexposure, she felt like, and it kind of the NCAA targeted you and kind of went after you. If you were around today, do you feel like it would have helped you, or do you feel like having to deal with social media and being even more under the microscope would have been a hassle?
I mean, it would have helped me because you have a ready-made marketing tool with social media. I mean,
Yeah.
that's you can't get any bigger than Sports Illustrated. Like all these mixtapes and stuff, that's great, man. But you got to remember, before all of that, The pinnacle was Sports Illustrated, and I think it still have a stature still today. I mean, SI, the big deal was when they did, excuse me, the swimsuit edition. Everybody would look forward to that and see all the models and things like that. You know, the cover that I was, the issue I was in was when Brazil won the World Cup. You know, the title was Viva Brazil. There was a 4-page layout. I was 15 years old when
That's
that happened.
crazy. Yeah, that's
So we're
nuts.
talking about, yeah, we're talking about Zion Williams, but Zion Williams is a freak of an athlete today. But guess what? I played against Ronnie Fields out of Chicago. He had a 50-inch vertical leap at 6'3". I mean, this dude, he did stuff that you wouldn't even expect him to do at his size, number one, and the way he elevated. He played with Kevin Garnett. It was unreal. He was playing with KG, and Ronnie Fields was the guy of folklore in the city of Chicago at that time. But KG was something that the world has never seen. So it was inevitable, his trajectory. Well, we were all peers. I played against Kevin too. Kevin speaked on my legacy and my career and what it was like playing against me. You know, these guys are guys that I came up and made my name against, and these guys were the best in their area, and we all came together, and it was a magnificent experience. I don't know if they'll ever see basketball like that again, because we're living in different times. But Zion is probably the closest thing to what I was as far as the explosiveness. But my skill set was much better at this phase in the game, and I think if he can develop his guard skills and his mid-range, he's going to be unstoppable because he's already a problem around the basket.
What advice would you give to a guy like Zion? I know you talk to kids and younger players today and, share your story, share advice. What advice would you give to someone like Zion, where the expectations are so high and who's gotten so much attention from a young age? Zion or anyone that's in a similar position, what would your advice be for them?
Stay humble and don't believe the hype. Keep working, you know, because you're only as good as your last game, and it's the ball's gonna stop bouncing someday. And for Zion, he's overcoming an injury right now, so he's really got to come back and really prove himself, and, you know, show he's worthy of not only the money but, you know, the first round pick status and just this magnitude of media that's pushing him, that's behind him. He has to make good on that. So stay focused. Don't believe that everything that you hear, you know, and just work, you know, stay in the lab, just work, stay away from distractions. Because, you know, when you got that bullseye on your back, everybody's targeting you. It's one thing to get to the mountaintop, it's another thing to stay there.
Let's talk about that. The NCAA investigated you, how you got your car, your stereo, and things like that. They invalidated your SAT score, so you weren't able to play at UCLA. And it seemed like a technicality. Basically, you had extra time on a on an essay to take your SAT because you had anxiety when it came to testing. It didn't seem like a very big deal. And Long Beach State initially was going to let you in, despite that, it didn't seem like a concern. And I love your mom, by the way. She seems amazing, and I loved how she was bashing the NCAA and defending
Thank
you.
you.
She seems awesome. Did it feel like the NCAA was picking on you or targeting you because you were getting so much attention and in the spotlight?
Absolutely. And I wasn't taking money from anybody, so I wasn't in bed with people, you know, which was not a norm at that time. Okay. So, and this was before everything right now. I was at the forefront of the AAU basketball scene on the West Coast, and our AAU team was the best in Southern California and on the West Coast for that matter. So there was a lot of things that was coming my way that I wasn't really prepared for, that I was learning on the move, because my parents weren't basketball people. They didn't play sports growing up. You know, my father was a hardworking construction worker and drove trucks across country and had his own business. And, you know, my mother was very astute. She handled all the paperwork and, you know, the money and things like that. College educated, went to UCLA, graduated from there, and met my father, you know, conceived two children, me and my brother. And you know, we took this opportunity and ran with it. You know, I think we're still successful in our own right. My brother made it to the NBA, played 4 years. I didn't. I was able to play at a high level 10 years internationally, Europe, South America, Asia, all throughout the world. But I have a wealth of knowledge and experiences to give back to the youth, to the kids, and to people that want the service. You know, this isn't for everybody. This life is not for everybody. Everybody's not gonna make it. You know, you want me to quote statistics? Let's talk numbers now. You know, for a kid to make it to a Division I high D1 university, he's got a 1% chance as a student athlete out of high school. To make it to the NBA, you have less than a 1% chance. So my message is to never quit and diversify. That way you're not left startled when the ball stops bouncing, you have options and you have more of a smooth progression into the workspace.
For sure. And I agree with, you know, some of the experts and people that were interviewed in the doc. They were saying your story may have, you know, you may have a bigger impact now because of the fact that you didn't play in the NBA, because now all these kids can look at your story and you can share with them your advice and kind of say, look, you have to have a plan B. You have to, there's nothing wrong with going overseas and making a, you know, having a 10-year career over there. That's an amazing career. But I think a lot of people can take from that, from your story, and really learn, especially players that are being hyped up and in the spotlight. You know, all it takes is one injury or certain circumstances, and that can fall apart. So I think that's a valuable lesson for sure. You ended up at UCLA, as I mentioned, and before your SAT score was invalidated, you spent the summer there. Baron Davis mentioned in the doc that you were dominating the UCLA pickup games against guys like Magic Johnson, Penny Hardaway, Hakeem Olajuwon. In the documentary, they also talk about how in high school you played against Kevin Garnett, Kobe Bryant, got the better of them. I mean, these are legends that we're talking about. What do you remember from those pickup games at UCLA?
I was having fun. You know, I mean, it didn't really matter who was in front of me. I had a killer's mentality. So, you know, in these same legends that you talk about, I mean, I came out with the likes of guys like Kobe, rest in peace. But Kobe couldn't do nothing with me either when we played. You know, I was a problem because I had a chip on my shoulder.
A number of people in the documentary talk about how you were LeBron James before LeBron James, as far as your game, the national attention, the hype, the athleticism. When I watched this, I was thinking LeBron went through a lot of the same things that you did, the national hype, an SI feature, an NCAA investigation into his car, you know, things like that. And I don't think LeBron gets enough credit for the way he handled the national attention at a young age and how he somehow exceeded expectations despite the crazy hype. How impressed were you with how LeBron James handled everything, you know, when you watched him come up?
Very impressed. I mean, it's not easy, you know, when that bullseye's on your back and they're targeting you. I think when you achieve a certain level of success, everybody loves to bring the top dog down and they want to see him fall. So to see him handle that with class and dignity, and, you know, to be a man of integrity and obviously about his family, you know, no issues outside of basketball and stuff like that. Off the court, you know, he's maintained his relationship with his wife and taking care of his kids and just having a good rapport and a good track record and a clean image and outside, you know, as a professional is important typically in the Black community, because there's a lot of things that can tear us down, you know, along the way that's obviously put there for a reason. So that's impressive to me. But what he's doing today as far as the social injustice is more impressive to me, considering some of the other athletes with big names from the inner city had platforms and opportunities to do it and chose not to. So I really respect him for that, especially in the temperature of our nation right now.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's been great to see him use that platform. And people don't talk about the fact that players that get hyped up and are getting that national attention when they're 12 years old, like in your case, or in high school, they're basically child stars. I mean, we look at music or the, you know, film industry and things like that, and we look at what happens to child stars, and typically they end up really struggling. We know there's mental health issues, there's addiction, there's things like that. But for whatever reason, whenever we see, you know, 12, 13, 14-year-old basketball players or any kind of athletes, and we give them national attention, we don't kind of consider it the same way. The fact that a guy like LeBron James has been able to have that kind of life, the fact that you've been able to go on and deal with that kind of attention and have a 10-year career overseas and do everything that you've done, you know, do you think people should start looking at athletes at that age like child stars and kind of considering it the same way that we look at the music industry or the movie industry?
I think so. I mean, it's a gift that you're blessed with and you're able to entertain. You know, it's like I call basketball like it's like art, you know, like painting a Picasso or something like that. You know, it's a lot like that. You know, you go through these progressions as a process to get to a certain level to be a supreme athlete. You know, then you have to become a student. So you're studying the game. You're learning your body. You're learning about nutrition. You know, you're learning about your opponents. And you're learning about the media, how to interact with leeches and parasites and agents and handlers, you know, from young. I mean, I had grown-ups running at me at 13, 14 years old, man. Like, how do you prepare for that? You have to have somebody that has been there where you're trying to go and has been successful to mentor you. in order for you to have a leg to stand on to be successful, because it's very difficult.
Yeah, for sure. I think no one knows how they're going to handle that kind of attention, or like you said, having adults suddenly, you're basically the boss at that age. No one knows how they're going to
Right.
handle that situation until they're actually in it. So I think people who criticize, these child stars, they don't understand what that life is like. So yeah, I just think it's interesting. We're starting to see that more and more with basketball, and the fact that so many guys have been able to come out of that and not run into those same issues that we've seen from the music industry or the movie industry, it's just great to see. But let's talk about, in the documentary, a number of experts were asked, and other top players were asked, why didn't Shai make it to the NBA? And they try their best to answer, but we didn't actually hear your answer in the documentary. How would you answer that question? Why didn't Shai make it to the NBA?
It wasn't meant for me. God had a different plan for my life. I think, and I'm coming into that now. People have to remember in life, there's four quarters. I'm in my third quarter right now. And the goal is to finish strong. No matter how you start, it's how you finish. So, I put everything I had into it. It didn't work in my favor long term as far as the NBA with a 20-year career like the likes of a Kobe Bryant, may he rest in peace. But, I feel like my lane that I'm taking is going to be more valuable for me than what I did when I played on the basketball court. What I'm doing off the court now to build up the youth of America and make this a better place, one kid at a time, is more important because this is going to impact their lives from here on out.
When I was watching the documentary, I saw, I think it was Ivan Rabb that you were talking to. I think I spotted him in there. He's obviously went on to have an NBA career. And so my question for you is, how receptive are guys when you tell your story? The fact that you can say, look, I know what I'm talking about. I was able to get the better of KG and Kobe and all these different guys in games. You immediately have their attention. What message are you spreading, and how receptive have they been?
Just to take advantage of the opportunity, be the best you can be while you can. Take advantage of your academics, get the best grades you can get. Network when you're in class, build friendships and rapport with your classmates. Take advantage of your coaches, and if you don't have any positive role models at home, then gleam to mentors, your coaches or AAU coach or an aunt or uncle or somebody that's investing in you. That wants to see you succeed and that cares about your well-being. I think that's what's more important, what people are missing today, because everybody is about the gratification of the microwave mentality. Right now, I need it right now, right now. They don't like the process. If they can't see it happening, they don't believe it's going to happen. So it's about the process in life and the journey. And Ivan was very receptive. And a lot of kids are receptive because when they do their homework on me, they ask questions. And when they ask their coaches, they give them the same advice in return. They're like, no, this dude was legit. He was the man. So, when you hear that from people that you respect, it's a built-in understanding, and I don't have to really sell anything. I'm just giving a message.
I loved at the very end of the documentary, your father says it would be amazing for Shai to kind of develop and coach the next, great prospect, the next phenom that comes out. He was saying that would just be, poetic justice if you helped bring the next Shai Cotton essentially along and helped him get to the NBA and helped him make it. And I do want to say I'm sorry for your loss with your father. He seemed like a
Thank
great
you.
man.
Thank you.
What would that mean to you to be able to coach or mentor someone and help them get to that NBA, the pinnacle, and help a phenom like that?
It would be a dream within a dream because it would be, the obvious, the epitome of a sacrificial lamb, where it didn't work for me, it could work for someone else, and I could pour in all of my experiences into that one individual. So, they can take that opportunity and truly flourish because then they'll have opportunities and they'll have, the experience off the floor to know how to handle things as a professional, which is a lot of guys' pitfalls. And that's what I think eventually before it's over with, that will happen. And I think it's not going to be just one person. I think it's going to be several guys, to be honest, before my time is up. I have kids that I've impacted right now in this area. I mean, at least five or six kids that'll probably play high Division I basketball. My AAU team was ranked top 20 in the country in 16 months with no sponsorship, okay? Private money. So, and we went from no ranking to that title, and now I have a kid who's top five in the country that played on my team, Marquise Cook out of Portland, Oregon, Jefferson High School. ESPN top 25. He's number five right now.
Wow.
So there's blessings that are in disguise sometimes, but it's how you view life. The glass is half full or it's half empty.
For sure. One part of the documentary I want to discuss, after not being able to play at UCLA, you talk about soul searching, feeling depressed, feeling embarrassed, you know, show your face back home because everyone kind of expected you to go be this top prospect and play in college. You talk about even feeling suicidal at one point. When Greg Oden was on the podcast recently, he talked about the same thing. After, you know, his numerous injuries and when his NBA career came to an end, he didn't know who he was or what his hobbies were, even what he wanted to do for the rest of his life, because basketball was all he knew. And he even says, you know, that all of his self-worth came from basketball, and he started drinking daily, abusing opiates, you know, feeling depressed, suicidal. It's something that he talked about in the podcast and was very open about it. You know, how tough was that period for you? And, you know, having to learn life is more than basketball, your self-worth isn't just tied to basketball. How difficult was that when that's what everyone was praising you for from the age of, you know, 11, 12 years old on?
Life changing. You know, it really tested the core, the fiber of my being to see how bad did I want to succeed and be somebody that, you know, my daughter can be proud of. You know, my mother can be proud of. You know, my father be looking down, smiling at me, you know, and just somebody that can be a tool that can be utilized to help people for the better. You know, like where I struggled, I want people to succeed. You know, where I did well, where other people may struggle, I can get back and give them insight to help curb those learning curves and things like that. That's more important to me today, aside from what I did playing basketball. I mean, my father was raising a accountable, hardworking man of God. Myself and my brother, and I feel like him and my mother accomplished that goal. The basketball thing, it's a 50-50, man. Everybody's not going to make it. People don't realize how hard it is to make the NBA. You know, I was ranked top 10 in the country all through high school. So people can say whatever they want. They want to call me a high school legend, this, that, and the third. I played a lot of basketball after high school, okay? Even after I was getting the jerk chicken, I like to call it, when people were screwing me over, you know, in my career. Take LeBron. You take him in his pinnacle, and you take 2 years out of his career where he's got to pretty much wait on the sideline. You think he'd be the same player today? Not close.
Yeah.
Not a chance. Because 85% of the game is mental. And I fought through those difficult periods, even through, you know, the suicidal tendencies at times, because I knew at the end of the day there was something more out here for me. So when people watch the documentary, I think they're going to get that resilience and, you know, that determination and that hunger just from watching all the hardships that I've overcome, which is why I'm the man I am today. All those adversities I've had to face.
Well, I'm glad you're not in that dark place anymore. And I just want to say thanks for being open and sharing those things in the documentary, because I think that will help a lot of people too, maybe who are struggling with something similar or going through a hard time, to be able to see what you've accomplished since then and how you got yourself out of that. You know, that's great to see as well. You mentioned having a daughter. How excited are you to be able to show her this documentary? And, you know, she may not understand just how dominant her father was as a basketball player and what he accomplished. Is it nice to be able to show her, hey, watch this and you can see, you know, just how great daddy was at basketball back in the day, and make her understand kind of your story and your life a little bit more?
Yeah, it's just dope, you know, for me to be able to bond with her and connect through a film. You know, she's a smart girl. She's athletically inclined. She has the genes, obviously. I don't know if she understands the magnitude just yet, but I think as she gets older, people will fill in the gaps for her, you know, with those things. I think my relationship with her is more about the time that we can share together, because I don't get as much with her because, you know, me and her mother are separated. But I want my daughter to know that her father fought for everything that he was able to accomplish, and he never quit. So that's my message for kids. No matter what you face, don't ever give up. And nobody can tell you what you can and can't do. You have to believe in yourself when no one else does.
For sure. you went undrafted in the 2000 NBA draft, and it seems so crazy, especially when you look at how the draft is today. It's so much based on potential and upside, and we see teams take flyers on guys today just because they feel like, okay, even though, you know, he's raw, or even though he didn't have the best collegiate career, we're going to take a chance on him because he has this much potential and upside, and we can make it work. And then you talk about your situation going to the Orlando Magic. You almost played in Summer League with them, and then there was a tragedy. I won't get into that, so people can watch the documentary and hear more about that. But what was that draft night like for you? That had to be so devastating because, you know, you were one of those guys that potentially could have entered the NBA out of high school. I don't know. Obviously, it wasn't very common back then. Kevin Garnett did it, but it wasn't something that was like happening very often. You know, what was that draft night like for you? And did part of you wish you had left from high school and jumped right to the NBA?
That draft night for me was demoralizing, to be honest. I cried like a little baby after the draft. I had my family there. My agent was there, my trainer. Me and my brother had went to go grab some hot wings right before the draft started. I just spoke with, I believe it was the Utah Jazz, Minnesota Timberwolves, and the Clippers. They were all expressing interest and said, you know, they heard I'd be a mid-late first-round pick, that they expressed they had some draft picks, and that if I was around, that they were considering grabbing me. So I was feeling pretty good about my chances going into the draft. With that being said, we got back home. I wound up watching the first round. Obviously, my name wasn't called. They had my name on the board as one of the sleepers, Kenny Smith and some of the other analysts that were covering the draft at that time. Second round approached. I watched the whole second round, proceeded. My name wasn't called. I quietly got up from my seat, walked out of the house and took a walk around my neighborhood for probably about 20 minutes as I proceeded to cry like a baby and think about what I wanted to do with that next part of my life, because that door had been shut, that dream had been shattered, and I had to basically reinvent myself in the toughest way. You know, I'm at home, I made this name for myself, and everybody just knew I was gonna get my name called, and here it is, I don't even get drafted. And I'm still at home and I have to show my face and figure out where is my basketball career going to go, because I've turned pro to play for pay. And now being denied the right to work where I know I'm capable to earn a living. So I had a lot of pitfalls, you know, and I was young going through a lot of this stuff. So this stuff breaks people. This stuff changes people. Like you talk about Greg Oden, he made it to the NBA. Okay. He got the multi-millions. I never got my payday. That's what people don't realize. Yeah. So for me to be here today is not easy. Okay. It's a blessing. I'm so grateful to have this platform. And we're really excited about June 23rd. And, you know, and the impact this documentary is going to make, not just nationwide, but globally, because it's going across the water.
That's awesome. Yeah, and you seem like you're handling it well. You seem like you have a very positive outlook and you're in a good place, which is great to hear. People don't realize, though, you know, playing 10 years overseas isn't easy. That's a really impressive career. You know, as you mentioned, you played in Serbia, China, France, Dominican Republic. You know, you were all over the place. You can make good money overseas, and the competition over there is great as well. What was your experience like in your decade as a professional player overseas?
It was good. You know, it was tough early on, the first few months, you know, in new countries, it was always tough getting acclimated with the cuisine, you know, the language and just the lifestyle. Things are a lot slower when you go abroad. Typically in Europe, it's more of a simple lifestyle, which you learn that you can live with a lot less, and you can be happy with things that you take for granted in America. You can be happy without those things, you know, and I grew up so much because I went over to Europe at 19 years old. I didn't have my handler, my agent going with me. I didn't have my girlfriend, family members and things like that. I went over by myself. You know, I would talk to my mother daily and my family as much as I could, but I tried to do it on my own because I felt if I can handle this internationally by myself, I'll be ready for life as an adult, no matter where I'm at. And I feel like I was able to accomplish that. The European experience basketball-wise was difficult at times because I'd play well and then I wouldn't play for two or three games. So there was some politics there also, which normally wouldn't happen in the NBA. Typically, when you play well, you get more minutes and you make more money too. So, you know, there was some challenges that I had to face early in my career. And then as I started to grow and get older, I handled things a lot better. And enjoy the experience a little bit more. But there's nothing like playing in the NBA. I mean, I still feel like my pro career was basically a slap in the face because I was denied the right to work where my talent basically allowed me to play. So how do you deal with that emotion?
Yeah.
So I feel like I handled that the best I could. And I was actually glad when I was able to retire because I didn't have to worry. Why did I make it to the NBA? What could I do to get back? And, you know, why aren't they calling my name? They're picking up all these other guys. I mean, I played in the ABA with Dennis Rodman and Matt Barnes and DeMar Johnson. You know, all those guys had got call-ups from there. As soon as they left, I was averaging almost 40 a game, and the scouts were long gone. So it's a timing thing, and it's a situational thing as well.
For sure. People don't realize that, you know, like you said, it is timing. It's all about getting the right opportunity, impressing the right person. And there's so many different circumstances that have to fall into place for a guy to make it to the NBA. So, but I totally agree with you. It would have been so much fun to see what you could have done at that level. It's a shame that didn't happen. I think it's ridiculous that it didn't happen, just to be frank. But I love this story. I'm so glad that this documentary was made so that you can share your story and put it out there. I think it was well done.
Thank you.
I was really impressed. And I think everyone's going to really enjoy it on June 23rd when it comes out. It will be available on demand. It's also available on all digital platforms, iTunes, Amazon, anywhere you can buy movies. Be sure to check out Manchild, the Shea Cotton story. Shea, thanks for joining me, man. This was awesome.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I appreciate it, and I'm excited to see the release and how it's received. I know people are going to love it. If you want to hear more episodes of the Hoopsite podcast, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere podcasts are found. And until next time, thanks for listening.